This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, the day before Easter. And we have an exciting show for you today. My guest is going to be Dr. Jonathan Liss. He is a primary care physician, and he is in a private practice called Active Health. And it's located in central Connecticut. But the focus of his practice has been preventive medicine and how you can live longer. You know, I'm always hearing from friends and patients that they're having difficulty finding a primary care physician because there are so few of them out there. Their practices are full as people are living longer. So it's interesting to now let's talk to a primary care physician and find out what's going on in the field and how we can make this system maybe work a little bit better because they are crucial to our longevity and our basic medical health. And there's a lot of misconceptions too because there are a lot of people who use the term primary care, so we want to get that defined as well. Just getting back, I guess, I just want to continue a little bit of talking about some of the craziness going on in the health of our nation. I mean, it just continues every week. It gets more and more ludicrous. Let's go back to last week, okay? Now we have over 800 cases of measles in the United States. 600 of those are in West Texas. And we haven't stopped the spread of it. That will certainly go on into next year. The craziness is we know what stops it. It's a vaccine. People are refusing to take the vaccine, and instead they are spreading it to other people. So far, we only have 3 fatalities. That's 3 fatalities too many for a problem that's solvable. The other thing that happened this week, we had our 80th mass shooting of this year. 80 mass shootings this year in the United States. How does that relate to health? Gun control. Let's just talk about basics, okay? Because I hear from the gun people, well, these are people with mental health disorders. Yeah, I agree with you. Why are we giving them guns? If we don't do a background check, we're not going to know who has a mental health disorder that we are giving access to a gun. So it's time we got smart. Instead, in the state of Florida, where this happened, they are going to now make their gun control laws more liberal from the standpoint that you don't have to be 21 years old to purchase a weapon. So they want to lower the age of a weapon and get rid of all background checks. So once again, we need to look at that. But this week, I've got to get back to our top health official in the United States, Robert F. Kennedy. He has now gone on the attack to really belittle people with intellectual differences. To the point where in an interview, actually in a speech he made, he used the R word. Not a word I'm going to repeat. But he used the R word. You know, he didn't use it in a derogatory sense, but he used it. And he's joined his two buddies there, Joe Rogan and Elon Musk, who have now begun to try to use that term and bring it back into the vernacular. Right? They start using it. And we're supposed to be comfortable with that word. Robert F. Kennedy's aunt, Eunice Shriver, and his uncle, Sergeant Shriver, founded Special Olympics. Special Olympics for people with intellectual differences to participate in sports so that they could be part of the sports community. And I'm very proud to be a volunteer for that group here in Connecticut. It's a wonderful experience. But when we talk about people with intellectual differences, we talk about another word that has taken on a bad connotation, and that's diversity. Yes, that is diversity. When we embrace people who are different than us, whether it be intellectually or otherwise, it's something that's part of being human. So for him to even use that word in any context as the top health official in this country is deplorable. But then we hear about autism. This is a topic that Robert F. Kennedy ran on, he's now in charge of, and he has said the autism epidemic is running rampant. Here's how he defines the epidemic. And we need to go into this. I'm just going to try and explain this as basically as I can. A recent report showed that one in 31 8-year-olds has autism. And that's up from 1 in 36. Previously, it was much more rare. The reason being that we have changed the classification of autism to now where it is a spectrum of disorders. So let me try to use something that we all understand. Let's use cancer, right? Cancer, there's not one type of cancer, right? It's a spectrum that falls onto this broad category of cancer. Autism is the same. Instead of just saying it's one specific thing, and 30 years ago, when we heard the word autism, we indeed thought of someone who is severely disabled. But that's not the case now. And then he goes on to say that he has now vowed to discover the cause and eliminate exposures by September of this year. He's either not familiar with the English language or really coming from another planet to say he would discover the cause. He went on to say people with autism will never play baseball, date, pay taxes, or have a job. Now, this prompted thousands and thousands of social media posts from people who have autism and pay taxes. These are people who have jobs, very responsible jobs. In fact, there are physicians who I have worked with who are on the autism spectrum. In fact, they made a television show about someone, right? They called it The Good Doctor. That wasn't all made up. That wasn't Hollywood. It was someone who had, by definition of autism, when you think of autism, it's someone whose brain works differently. They have challenges talking, making friends, playing with others, things like that as children. So there are people on that spectrum who are heralded scientists, writers. So the fact that he could make a comment that these people, he even went so far to say these people will never be able to use a toilet, just shows his ignorance and the fact that he is so unqualified to be part of the government and the healthcare structure. But let's get back to it. Let's talk about autism itself, because it's a developmental disability. We already spend $300 million yearly researching autism. And some of the risk factors we know are prenatal exposure to pesticides or air pollution, extreme prematurity, low birth weight, and certain maternal health problems, such as women conceiving at an older age. We also know that there is a big genetic component to it. So let me get back to the analogy with cancer. Same thing with cancer, right? Environmental causes. We know smoking causes cancer, so we work on that. We know there's genetic predispositions to cancer, very similar to autism. Does everyone have the same endpoint from cancer? Absolutely not. And that's not the case with autism. So we need to really get these folks in our government, the people who are in charge of our healthcare, to really reframe their thought. He has now gone on to fire the person who was in charge of vaccines because he feels that it's all about vaccines. Vaccines are the single cause of autism. This has been studied time and again. And the one thing we know about autism with certainty is it's not related to vaccines. But he has now hired David Geer, a man who has repeatedly claimed a link between vaccines and autism, to lead the autism research effort. I'm laughing because that's like going on, getting involved in a scientific project where you start with your conclusion and work backwards. Now, naturally, you have a hypothesis, but you have to be objective. There's no objectivity here. So he's going to spend our tax dollars and start researching something we're already familiar with and have been working on for a long time. So the diagnosis of autism has expanded. It has broadened. And the reason being, we're more aware of it. We're more aware of the findings of someone who may be on this spectrum. We also diagnose it now at a younger age. And we do that so that we could provide services for young people who are on that spectrum, so that they also become productive members of society and, as he put it, pay taxes. Because I guess that's the bottom line here, not a productive life. We're going to keep up with this story, but every week there's a new one. So I have no loss of material for this program, thanks to Robert F. Kennedy. This day in medicine, April 19, 1910, the first successful treatment of syphilis with a compound called 606. It really is a medication that was the first chemotherapy and antibiotic made from an arsenic derivative. And really, it revolutionized the treatment of all infectious diseases. It's essentially the first antibiotic, and it was developed by Dr. Paul Ehrlich, who was a German bacteriologist. And it successfully treated syphilis, but had a lot of toxic side effects because of the arsenic derivative. But with that, he came up with the first successful, and essentially, his discovery in 1909 and the later application on April 19th, 1910, changed medicine forever. With that, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. John Liss. We're talking about primary care, questions you may have about primary care, the role of the primary care physician in your life. If you wish to reach out to me with questions for Dr. Liss, I'm at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome my guest today, Dr. Jonathan List. Dr. List is a primary care physician at Active Health, a practice in Central Connecticut, and it's great to have him. John, welcome to the show.
Tony, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So, John, let's start right with let's go over your background. So how did you end up becoming a primary care physician?
Well, I think it sort of all started when I was a kid growing up. I got injured a lot, and kind of primary care from a pediatric standpoint was really what I was exposed to. And then as I went through schooling, I'm really a Connecticut townie, so to speak. I've never really left the state training at Wesleyan, UConn, and then Yale. And sort of all going through that, I knew primary care was kind of what I wanted to do. It's a good blend of, you know, just talking to people, meeting them where they're at, and kind of knowing a lot about everything. You know, we're sort of the jack of all trade, master of none in medicine. And I like that. So that's sort of my, my circuitous route in a sense to primary care.
You know, primary care takes on different terms because obviously I think when people think of primary care, they think of family medicine and doctors who are delivering babies, doing pediatrics and adult medicine. And in some places, obstetrics is considered primary care since they are the principal physicians for women. But your specialty is internal medicine, correct?
That's correct. Yep.
Internal medicine. So how do you fit into this?
So good question. So internal medicine is a branch of primary care. We treat only adults, though, anyone 18 and older. My oldest patient, 106. So all the way through, you know, 18 and older. It's sort of, you know, family medicine, internal medicine in the sense of a generalist, or as I like to call myself, a preventionalist, someone who focuses more on like preventive health, is certainly part of the primary care spectrum.
That's a great way to put it. Let's talk a little bit about the role of the primary care physician in the health. You said a lot of it has to do with being the quarterback, but you also said something very important, and that is preventive medicine. Have we spent enough time focusing on preventive medicine, or has our healthcare system focused too much on just treating disease?
Well, I think that's by the nature of your question, I think you can probably assume that I'm going to say that we need to focus a lot more on preventive health. I think that's where we make our population healthier. I think that's where we make individuals healthier. I think that's how we get into really proper health span promotion, which is kind of achieving better health throughout life, better functionality throughout life. And Tony, I know you're a football fan, and so I like the quarterback analogy, but I think perhaps as a primary care doc, I might be more like the middle linebacker in the sense that I'm on defense. I'm kind of trying to prevent things from happening, right? But I'm still getting the play calls. I'm still kind of leading the team on the defensive side of the ball. So I may be more of I'm a big Ravens fan, maybe more of a Ray Lewis than a Tom Brady, perhaps. But the analogy fits.
That's a great analogy. We have a few minutes left. What are the principal problems people come into you with? Okay, so we know not everybody is plugged into preventive medicine, right? They go to you right when they're sick, or they start a relationship when they are faced with the challenge. What are some of the common things that you see in the office every day, John?
Yeah, sure. So I think the common things that I see every day are pretty much what mirrors the prevalence of disease in the country, and those are things to name some examples, things like cardiovascular disease, which is like hypertension, coronary artery disease, heart failure management, things like metabolic diseases like diabetes and obesity, a lot of infections, people coming in with colds, a lot of viral infections, some bacterial infections like pneumonia, skin rashes, things like dermatitis, cellulitis, some psychiatry stuff, dermatology, neuro. We're pretty broad in that. I don't, as you were kind of talking earlier about, you know, the autism piece, I don't really manage that a ton. I, again, don't do kids. I don't do a ton of primary oncology, but we really can see anything in primary care. And again, that's one of the reasons I love it.
That's great. We're chatting today with Dr. John List, and Dr. List is a primary care physician. His practice is called Active Health. If you wish to reach out to him, and I'll give the number again later on, but the phone number to reach out to Dr. List is 860-868-8932 or his website, acthealth.org. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to really drill down on preventive medicine and the things we need to do to stay healthy. And we're going to talk with Dr. List about what makes his practice different in that respect. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with my guest today, Dr. Jonathan List. Dr. List is a primary care physician, and just before the break, we were talking about doing more in terms of preventive health and longevity, something we talk about on this program a great deal. John, so let's talk a little bit about it. How do you approach this problem with your patients in terms of preventive care and longevity?
So great question. And first of all, let me say, I love the intro music. I think that's, it puts me in a good thinking mood. So I love that. But I think the, really where I start in terms of this, you know, longevity is a very popular topic right now. There is a lot of people from influencers to people, actual physicians, all along the spectrum talking about longevity, and you hear it all over. But I think really the thing that's much more important than that is health span. And longevity really just is how long you live. You know, right. You're born and you die. That's longevity. Health span is how long you stay healthy and functional. And ideally, your health span equals your longevity. Ideally, you're healthy and functional up until the day you die. But often in this country, we keep people alive far longer than they are functional and far longer than they can do the things that they enjoy doing, whether that's golf, exercise, picking up their grandkids, things like that.
So you're taking quality into consideration.
Yes, I think you have to. I think you have to see, you have to ask the patient, first of all, what's important to them. For some people, perhaps it is living a very long life and just the amount of life you're living is the most important thing. And certainly there's some interplay there. But I think what I start by doing is asking a patient, okay, what are your goals? What do you want to be able to do when you're, you know, 70, 80, 90 years old? And then kind of working backwards from there, what are the things that we need to do now to focus on so that we can get to that point and, you know, with a fairly good degree of confidence that you'll get there. And again, there, as we know in medicine, there's a lot of things that can pop up, accidents or sudden diseases that are unexpected. But I think you really have to, start backwards from what a patient's goal is at an older age.
So let's kind of focus in on that a little bit. What are the most common goals you hear? So when you sit with a patient and you ask that, what are most people telling you? Most people say, listen, I just want to live long, or are they talking about still athletics or interacting with family? What how does that conversation go, John?
That's a great question. I think the overarching theme that's the main thing that I hear is people just don't want to be a burden on somebody else. And that's sort of a general statement, but most people don't want to have to depend on a family member, a spouse, a caregiver in their older age. They want to be able to do what we term in medicine, the activities of daily living, the things that you can, you know, showering, brushing your teeth, getting dressed, going to the bathroom, feeding themselves. That's as the most basic need. They want to be able to do those things up until the day that they die. And most of the kind of the other goals that people have are typically involved or typically revolve around family. So they want to be able to still play with their grandkids. They still want to be able to fly. And, you know, one of the classic things that you hear is like to put luggage in the overhead bin. People want to be able to walk around the block. People want to be able to golf and walk nine holes. And those are getting a little bit less into the, you know, less frequent goals. But I think the main one that we hear most of all is people just, they don't want to be a burden to family members.
So let me tell you the one I hear. I mean, because I go through this with patients all the time. And everybody thinks they should drive a car till the day they die. How do you deal with that? No, really, because people think it's a birthright. And it's hard to have that conversation. How do you approach that? Because, not only are they a danger to themselves, but they're a danger to others. And I see this, you know, and it could be driving, it could be, you know, climbing ladders. I want to clean my gutters.
Right.
I mean, just how do you approach the driving question, John?
Yeah. And I'm laughing simply because this is something similarly I see fairly often. And it's a tough conversation to have. I think behind that is the fact that people often feel a loss of independence when driving is taken away from them. And that can be a really difficult milestone in a sense. But typically what I'll frame the question as, and ideally if there's family there as well, they can help, because oftentimes there's a son or a daughter or a grandchild who's saying, okay, listen, like, I agree, you probably shouldn't be driving. We've already taken away the keys or tried to, you know, get you rides and things. But oftentimes we try to frame the question in terms of safety, not necessarily for them. If they get an accident and they hurt themselves, they're the only ones to blame. But God forbid you injure someone else, or you're the cause of someone else's, you know, accident, injury, or death. And I think having that conversation with patients to kind of externalize it a little bit has been helpful. Again, ideally with some family support. And then there are also some, places you can get evaluated for driving in the state. And so sometimes we'll point patients to those resources as well to take an objective test and, you know, prove to us that they are safe to drive. Oftentimes they are not, though.
You know, one of the things that's always frustrated me, and I'm sure it's come up with you, like, people will live their lives and get ready to retire, and then they say, I'm moving to the woods, okay? I always wanted to have a cabin in the woods in some isolated part. In eastern Connecticut, everybody wanted to move up towards Putnam and be in the woods, but that's got to be the worst place for them, where they're further from healthcare, further from public transportation if they need it. How do you approach those issues? Because, living conditions are a big deal. And people always want to live in my own house, right? And we understand that. They just have become familiar with that. But they can't really manage a house anymore. This is work, managing a house, not just the cleaning, but the upkeep. How do you go about those conversations, John? Because I don't envy you, because it comes on your shoulders more than anyone.
Oh, that's a great question. And it is difficult. I think oftentimes if people are having those conversations and we're worried about them being able to manage a house or being going back to the driving piece, being able to drive, at that point, sometimes it's even a little bit too late, right? It's not, I don't have a magic pill to reverse time. I can't make you instantaneously stronger, more flexible, less likely to fall. And so this is why it's really important to start much earlier along the health span journey. But more practically, it's a difficult conversation to have. I think, you know, whether you're going out into the, you know, like Putnam, the eastern part of the state, beautiful part of the state. But you're right, it has a little less health density, I suppose, healthcare density. I think, you know, as technology improves and as, you know, Uber and ride sharing and things like that become more accessible and senior centers offer, you know, rides for folks, that might ease some of the burden. But to be honest, Tony, I don't have a great answer for you as to, you know, like a one size fits all kind of conversation there. It's really patient specific. And it's a really difficult conversation to have. But again, this is why I think it's important to start earlier with patients and say, okay, you're 40, you know, you want to retire by the time you're 65. What does that look like for you in terms of where you want to be? Okay. You want to be in a, you know, more rural location. How do we make that happen? How do we do that safely? And how do we avoid, you know, any type of harm that might befall you out there?
John, let's move on to, let's get into some specifics. Somebody comes into your practice and wants to live longer, obviously, and have a better, improve their health span and the quality of their life. How do you go about your assessment and recommendations? How do you get people on the right track?
That's a great question. So I think where we start with the assessment, especially at Active Health, is we try to take as much objective data as we can, and data that are tied into published studies to say, okay, here's how you, the individual patient, compares to other people around your age, and how is your health in comparison to them? And oftentimes we'll do that through VO2 max testing. We'll do that through body composition testing, which is like body fat percentage and muscle mass, that the skeletal muscle mass that patients have, you know, blood work that they're doing. And we'll say, okay, here's how you compare to someone your age. Say you're doing, you know, considerably better than someone your age. Here are the specific recommendations to make that, you know, to maintain that, essentially. Or say you're doing much worse than somebody your age. We really need to be aggressive in terms of our recommendations of the things that work in terms of health span promotion. And that, of course, begs the question, what works? And despite what you might read or despite what you might see online or on TikTok or things like that, there's a lot of snake oil out there, and snake oil is my term for things that don't work.
Well, let's talk
and
about
so
that.
Yeah. So the things that do work, unfortunately, are not that appealing to people in the sense that they're not new and exciting and flashy. But the things that work beyond a shadow of a doubt are exercise, and that's like dedicated physical activity, and not just being or avoiding being sedentary. It's actual exercise. It's really good sleep quality. It's not eating too much, and we know pretty much in every animal species that we've studied, animals that eat slightly less calories live longer. It's strong social connections, and then a little bit of good genetics, which you can't change that last piece. But that's really it. There is certainly a lot of nuance in how we approach each of those main pillars, but it's not a magic pill. It is not a blood test that makes you live longer. It's not following some guru that makes you live longer. It's really quite simple things that make you live much longer and healthier. And to be honest, it's avoiding the bad just as much as it is adding the good. So, you know, avoiding excessive alcohol, avoiding excessive calories, avoiding being sedentary, avoiding smoking, things like that are very well documented and studied health span promoters.
That's a great assessment overall. Let's talk about the snake oil. Now the big one I get all the time is Prevagen. Okay, is Prevagen, and we've had Dr. Cherish Smith on the show, who's a neurocognitive specialist, who has said there has been absolutely no proof that Prevagen avoids you from getting dementia or improves your cognitive abilities. But you know, there are so many things out there. I get them every day because people get them from the internet. So let's shift gears and talk a little bit about snake oil. And at the same time, how does the internet affect how you approach patients? Because they're all on it.
Yes. So, yeah, great question. Snake oil is becoming more and more ubiquitous. It's becoming more and more of an issue that we see on a daily basis. And I think it's really just based on the fact that now anyone on the internet has a voice. Anyone with an opinion can, make that opinion heard by thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. I think an easy heuristic to identify snake oil is, and I agree with you completely on the Prevagen piece, but speaking a little bit more globally, snake oil supplements or interventions, that type of thing, are often either oversimplified, like, okay, take this one supplement or vitamin and you'll live forever, or over complex, like fancy tech that measures a bunch of metrics that don't really matter whatsoever, or it promises like a quick and easy fix. And there really is no shortcut to better health. There is no shortcut. There are things that help you more than others, yes, but there's really no shortcut. So if you find yourself looking at an advertisement online of a product that is, you know, either overly simplified, overly complex, or promises a quick or easy fix, turn the other way and don't spend your money on that.
It's kind of interesting the way you bring that up, because what frustrates me is sometimes I'll see patients who are economically challenged, to say the least, having trouble even paying rent. But yet, all of these kind of snake oil things that we're talking about charge cash. Right. It's
right.
A cash investment. It could be. And it was funny because we go through these phases. I remember when, and it may be back there, everybody had to be on CoQ10. Right. No, it's not that CoQ10 is bad for you, but, you know, it is not a panacea. You're not going to get everything's not going to get better with CoQ10 or particular vitamins. But, you know, there's the economics of it. And I think a lot of what we're talking about revolves around economics, being able to, afford certain things like, if you need to go into a facility or assisted living and things such as that. I think that's a big part of it. And it's hard to alert people. But I want to move on to, again, the internet and people, getting information from what are unreliable sites and things like that. Can you share with our listeners some of the sites that you find to be more reliable and more trustworthy overall?
Absolutely. And I might differ from the crowd a little bit in that I love when my patients bring in their own research, because that's an opportunity in my mind to educate them. That shows that they're invested at least somewhat in their health enough to look up things themselves. So I think typically the rules are you're looking for a place that oftentimes has an academic affiliation. So, you know, either a hospital or hospital system that you trust, a website with a .edu, you know, URL ending. But believe it or not, in this day and age, everyone is, or it's becoming more and more useful to use AI for this type of thing. And so I know that's a little bit of a trigger word for a lot of folks, but I don't have a problem when patients use something like ChatGPT or Claude AI, or there's Open Evidence is another one that is specifically for medical questions. But the caveats there is that I tell patients they've got to use it in asking for both confirming and disconfirming evidence of whatever they're asking for. So say they're asking, you know, should I be on a statin? Is a common question I get. So you have to look at both the positive evidence and the negative evidence. You can't just look at the negative evidence and bring that to me and say, okay, I don't think I should be on this anymore. And I think it's still ultimately worthwhile seeing an actual healthcare provider, someone with a little bit of a little bit more objectivity. You know, as the saying goes, he or she who treats himself has a fool for a doctor. And so, you know, do your research, do your homework, of course, but bring that to someone else to have a conversation about it. It's you don't just treat yourself based on what you read on the internet is sort of the second kind of principle there that I tell patients.
Now, I may be revealing some of my ignorance, but how are people using AI for their medical information? I mean, they're just going on to ChatGPT and asking a question?
Yes, essentially. Yeah, it's essentially having a conversation with the AI interface, I suppose, to ask something like, okay, here are the lab results that I got from my primary care physician. Here is my medical history. And, you know, I would caution you about putting your medical history online, but, you know, opting for more general general inputs. And then they'll ask a question like, okay, should I be on XYZ medication? Or could, you know, medication A be causing side effects B in me? You know, what are some things I should look out for? But it really is. They're just, it's like Googling something, essentially, for lack of a better term.
I have a question here from Mike, and that is, how can you go about finding a primary care physician? And I think that that's a common challenge because so many are either retiring or people not going into the field. How do you go about finding a primary care physician?
That's a very good question. It's not easy to find a primary care physician. I think we're as a whole, we have generally tended to move more towards hospital-based medicine than outpatient office-based medicine. But I think starting with, like, if you have an insurance company, oftentimes you can look through them to see who's taking new patients. Sometimes that's not updated, though, so it's a little bit of a hit or miss piece. Asking around, asking people you know, word of mouth is still and probably always will be the best way to find a good recommendation. And then going towards like larger hospital systems, although, you know, I work for a small company, Active Health, we are a 3-doc practice. It is probably easier for most people to start at a larger institution or organization and then see what the primary care docs, who those people are and where they're located. But I don't have a great answer for you as to where to find them. You know, I think if you have an appointment with someone and you're trying to find what makes a good primary care physician, my first rule, and I think one of the most important rules, is that the doc has to practice what they preach. They've got to taste their own medicine. They've got to eat their own cooking. Meaning if they're, you know, staring at you smoking a cigarette and saying, hey, you've really got to stop smoking, that person has no credibility. But that's one example. I think you're also looking for a primary care doc that doesn't really over intervene, someone who's not just happy to prescribe you a million medications, especially at the first visit. And thirdly, someone who spends a lot of time with you, and especially that first visit, spends a lot more time listening than talking. And so those are the three things that I look for in a good primary care doc.
How about the use of physician extenders, for lack of a better term? A lot of people, you know, don't get to see the physician, right? They're treated by an APRN or PA. Do you utilize those in your practice, or is it just physicians?
In my current practice, I do not utilize them. I have absolutely nothing against them. In fact, my wife is an APRN. And so I think that the role in primary care is going to be increasingly filled by, you know, APRNs and PAs. And I think that's ultimately a good thing, because it gets more people access to be seen and essentially triaged, in the sense of, okay, is this an issue that really does require, you know, more urgent intervention or not? But I think that is certainly a growing thing, both in Connecticut and nationwide, and that something that patients should get used to seeing more of those types of providers.
Your practice is a little bit different, and we're seeing practices go to a membership model. Can you talk a little bit about that and how your practice works, and more importantly, are you taking new patients?
We are absolutely taking new patients and active health. We have locations in New Milford, New Preston, Wallingford, Waterbury, and we're going to be opening up our West Hartford location in early 2026. So we are taking new patients, but our practice is a membership-based practice. And what that means is that patients pay a membership fee to become a patient at the practice. Traditionally, I mean, this is not something that's novel, but traditionally, that's where it stopped. Patients would pay money to get access, and that was it. But we don't think that's really where the value is to the patient. And so what we do is we expand the services and really incorporate an interdisciplinary team. So we include, a gym, personal training, health coaching, a nutritionist, you know, cold plunge, a sauna, some custom online education. We've got expanded appointment times, same day and next day sick visits. And actually, as an aside, you know, probably a lot of people can relate to, you know, you call up your primary care office and I'm sick, I need an appointment. Okay, we can see in 3 months. It's like, that's okay. That doesn't really help many people if you're sick now.
Right.
So we think that's very important. And we really do have an incredible team. I think that we've assembled at Active Health in particular, which we're really proud of. But, you know, we try to make the primary care and preventive care experience one that is not just the doc and gives patients a lot more value than they put into it.
You know, I find this to be a great model. And also, you know, when people hear about the membership model, oh, I have to pay to go to the doctor. But, you know, most places aren't charging much more than you would spend to play tennis or golf or even join a gym.
No. And we have patients use their HSA as well to fund this. So
I didn't know that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That is outstanding. John, listen, and I want everybody to again know, if you wish to make an appointment with Dr. Liss or any of his colleagues at Active Health, call 860-868-8932 or go to acthealth.org. John, thank you for your time today, and thank you for all you do for folks in our community.
Tony, likewise, you have a great show here. You're doing a lot for the public, and thanks for having me.
Thank you. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board today. Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. As always on this program, I like to tell people where I'm going to be. If you have a chance to come down and say hello, whether I'm at a basketball game at Mohegan Sun or working a fight. So today, at the close of this show, I am going to be at the Hartford State Capitol for a rally. Okay, because today, it's time we got things online. I don't have to share any more detail with you. If you listen to this program, I'm not happy with the way healthcare is going in this country. I'm not happy with the way people are being treated. And I don't think it's going to get any better as people cut benefits for people with Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. So it's time people got up and did something. So I will be out there at the rally today supporting the folks there. And you might say, well, I can't go out there. I can't go marching or whatever. Well, guess what? You can email people. You can write letters. And more importantly, you can vote. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.